This is the I Love Success podcast. I'm Peter Drukowski, and I have made a vow to myself to help as many people as possible to achieve their dreams. Let's get started. Hey guys, and welcome back to the I Love Success podcast. This is the podcast where I meet the coolest and most successful people on the planet and share their stories. I'm glad to be on this journey together with you. What started as an idea has now become the start of a movement. My mission is to help 10 million people in 10 years to achieve their dreams. I can't do it myself, and because of that, I'm so grateful to all my amazing guests and listeners from all over the world. Thank you. Get ready to get inspired, because here we go. Before we get started, let's give it up to our sponsor, Panos Emporio. Panos Emporio is Scandinavia's leading swimwear brand and has over 30 years of experience in swimwear. Panos Emporio offers bikinis, swimsuits, swim shorts, briefs, cover-ups, accessories, along with a fragrance collection inspired by Paradise Islands. The brand has a worldwide loyal customer base with dedicated followers, ranging from Hollywood stars, top celebrity models, to world-famous athletes and royal families. Go to panos.com to learn more. Today's guest is a runner holding multiple American and world records, including the world record for most 100-mile races in a year and most 100-mile races ran in a lifetime. When he's competing, he always makes sure to put on a show, running dressed up as a jester, hence called the running jester. His name is Edwin Ettinghausen. He loves to inspire others. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me here.
So let's have some fun. I'm curious, who is Ed really as a person?
You know, I'm just a regular guy who happened to find that I had a passion for running and kind of came onto it later in life and just found that it was something that fulfilled me, and I found that I can inspire others by doing it and have a lot of fun and break some records.
That's pretty cool. So we're gonna share your journey as a runner, but let's go a little bit further back. Can you talk about growing up? But where did you grow up and how was life?
I grew up in foster care. I was removed from my mother's care at the age of 8 months old, as deemed by the court that she was unfit to care for me. She actually, not a fault of her own, she had mental illness. She was schizophrenic and bipolar. So because of that, she wasn't able to provide proper care. So I was placed in foster care, went through a number of foster homes, and eventually when I was 3 and a half, I came to a home that I stayed in. It was a stable home. It wasn't the most supportive home, you could say, but I had a place to sleep and food in my belly, and so that was my life. And as soon as I was able to kind of move out of that onto my own, I sort of took that opportunity and got married young and started living the American dream.
Cool. So was this in California or?
I was born in Sacramento, California. My mother moved to Las Vegas when I was a baby. And there's two stories and I never have looked into to find if either of these, which one is true, if either one are true. But one story is that she dropped me off at the Salvation Army as a baby. Another one is that they found us in an abandoned car in the desert and I had an ear infection, and that's when the courts got involved, determined that she was unfit. So Las Vegas was where I went into foster care, and eventually the family that I went into, they moved back to Northern California, which happened to be where they moved was within 30 miles of where I was actually born. Placerville, Northern California is near Sacramento. And so I grew up in Northern California, and eventually as an adult made my way down to Southern California.
Okay. And when you were a kid, did you in any way feel abandoned, or were you glad that you were in this foster care family? Have you thought about these things?
I have quite a bit. The family I grew up in, the parents, my foster dad had been born in 1902, my foster mother in 1920. So they were definitely Depression era people. They believed in the spare the rod, spoil the child. So they were very disciplined, very strict. You could even say borderline abusive. In today's standards, it would certainly be abusive for sure. But back in past generations, that was just the way you raised a kid. You slapped them, you spanked them, you did physical corporal punishment. So But I knew that something growing up, it just didn't feel quite right. I didn't feel like this was really the way that someone should be raised, but I had no reference point. So when I went before the judge at 12 years old, at that point, my foster father, who had become my adoptive father, was actually in an advanced stage of cancer, and actually he died within months after I was adopted. But there was a point where I went before the judge in chambers, and he said, "Now, this is your chance to tell me. You don't have to stay with this family if you don't want to. We will place you in another home, but this is it. Once you say yes, you will be adopted." And a part of me wanted to say, "I don't want to live with this family any longer." But I didn't know anything, didn't have any point of reference, anything to compare to. Now looking back, it wasn't a good environment that I was raised in, but I didn't know that at the time. So I didn't really know what I was missing until I became an adult myself, had children of my own.
Yeah, it must be very difficult when you're 12 to make those kind of decisions. And the reason I want to talk about this is that there are many people in this world that are in foster care or adopted or feel lonely in their own family or feel different. So I think it's important that we talk about this, and also how, if you could talk to these kids now, what would you like to say? What did you learn from this experience?
I learned resilience and self-reliance, and in a way that may have hurt me, because it took me a long time to get to a point in my adult life where I was willing to let people help me. I always felt that I couldn't really, and trust was a big issue too, to trust other people. It was hard for me to let people into my inner circle. I got married young at 19, and I've been married now for almost 36 years. And I have 4 adult children of my own and a grandchild. So my core family, you know, that's not an issue that. But outside of my core family, that has been an issue. And running has actually helped me to deal with that as well, because I've made a lot of friends. I didn't have a whole lot of friends even as an adult. I pretty much kept to my business, kept to my family and myself, just because of that uneasiness of making that connection, that bond, and having that trust established. So what I would tell to kids, to answer your question, is you will find love if you have love in your heart, and if you do the right thing, and if you treat others well and right and loving, love's going to come into your life. If you're bitter, there's many people who wear their bitterness on their sleeve. They had a bad childhood, and so they use that as an excuse. I don't use my childhood as an excuse, because I actually have a good life now. And I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't had to go through those hardships that were forced upon me. So I would have obviously preferred not to have gone through some of those things, but they made me, they helped make me who I am. So it's part of Ed. And so I would just tell kids, find your passion, be a good, kind person, be honest, and you'll find love. If you put love out there, love will come back to you.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And is family important to you now?
Extremely. Extremely important. That's the most important thing in my life.
Yeah. For me, family is very important too. And I think at the end of the day, family is everything we have, right? In one sense. And I like what you were saying. Don't let the circumstances define you as a human being. Because tell me one person that doesn't have problems.
Right.
It's just different layers, right?
That's true.
And how can we cope with that? How can we move forward from that? And I think community and sports are important for this, because it gives you a sense of belonging, right?
Yes.
And there's no one can, like when you finish a 100-mile race, no one can say you didn't do it, because it's right there. And no one can deny you, no matter how you look, what kind of clothes you wear, like nothing. And that's why I like sports so much, because it's transparent in that way, right?
I like that about the marathon, even more specifically about the 100-mile event, is that it doesn't matter what your background is, what your financial position is. We all come there with the same goal. And what's going to make a difference is what effort you put in the training beforehand and the effort you put in during the event. But you can't buy your way to a 100-mile finish line. You can't bribe your way. You just have to put that hard work in, and we're all on an even playing field. we all come looking, well, I don't look the same because I wear a jester outfit, but pretty much we all come in running clothes. So you can't tell anyone's status when they show up to the start line of a marathon. And I like that. It just evens the field.
Yeah, me too. And I think like working out and maybe especially running, it's like the best psychologist in the world, right?
It is. And you know, you asked me a question and I never quite answered that. And that is, when did I start loving myself? It really wasn't until I started running and finding success in running that I really started to feel like I was worthwhile. Yeah. I had had so much negative programming as a child. I'd been constantly told how I was a bedwetter, I was a pathological liar, I would hoard food because at one point, one of the foster homes I was raised in, basically they starved me. So I developed this habit of hoarding. I never developed a weight issue, surprisingly. I've always been at a good weight, never had an eating disorder. But so all those things I would do, I was a bad kid. And that's how my foster parents labeled me, as a bad kid. And so that's the programming that was in my head growing up. And even though I had a loving wife and had a successful business and things were going well for me, many kids that grow up in foster care doesn't work out well for them. They end up in prison or end up dead. But I really didn't truly feel worthwhile until I started doing these races and having success with that and making friends in that world, that I started feeling like, you know, I really can accomplish things. I'm not that little worthless child that I was made to feel I was. Even as an adult grown man, I still had that baggage that I kept with me for a long time. So it was really in the last 10 years, I would say, that I started to really, truly love myself.
And thank you for sharing that, Ed. And also, it's interesting because life can come in many forms and it's never late. That's what I like so much with you and why I wanted to share your story. It's like, when you were older, like most people, they don't start something like this when they're 46. And this is your journey which made you love yourself. And I think so many people out in the world have problems loving themselves, mm-hmm. just because there's no passion. And maybe people have told you things that you're not good enough or that you are a bad kid, like you said, or that you're skinny or short or fat or whatever it might be. But those passions that we have, they can actually help us, making us complete, right? Because in that community, you're accepted, right?
Mm-hmm. I am.
Even though you're crazy, right? Yes. Having that gesture.
Yes. And you know, the other thing I have to say is, luckily for me, even though I had a very bad childhood as far as the environment I grew up in, it wasn't supportive, but I had enough people, even as a child, that came into my life from time to time that made me feel loved. Teachers especially. I remember my first grade teacher was the first one that really made me feel like I wasn't the dumb, bad kid. And then I had a teacher that I loved in fifth and sixth grade, Mr. Robinson. Mrs. Breedlove was my teacher in first grade. I was in special education, and doing a math test, she found that I actually had good mathematical abilities, and she went to the principal. She actually got me and said, "Eddie, you come with me right now." She took me by the hand to the principal's office and said, "This child does not belong in my classroom." It wasn't because she wanted to get rid of me. It's because she knew that I actually wasn't mentally challenged per se. I just didn't have the right environment to flourish. And she knew that I had what it took to be mainstreamed into the classroom. And she's the one that got me into my first grade regular classroom. And then when I went into the fifth and sixth grade, I had a teacher that was just phenomenal, Mr. Robinson. And he just really, he understood me. I was kind of a class clown because I wanted to get a lot of attention. I can look back on that now and understand that's why I did what I did. But luckily for me, because I was a good student as well, I actually, you know, did well in school, that many of the teachers would kind of give me a little bit of a pass. And I think also they knew my background. So I probably got away with more than maybe some other kids might have, or maybe more than I should have. But I think because of that, because they showed love to me, that showed me that I was a worthwhile individual, that's what kept me on the right track. I could have very easily gone over. I even got involved in some things as a teenager, you know, doing some law-breaking things, and it could have gone either direction. But luckily, there were enough people in my life that steered me in the right direction, and that also showed me true love and kindness, and they had no vested interest. It was just purely out of the kindness of wanting to see a kid succeed.
And is that why you stick around even after you finish? You want to help others?
That's a part of it. It really is important to me to help those who are struggling. Because having gone through that, I know what that feels like, and I know how easy it can be to just give up. And I've had enough people tell me after a race, they will say, I meet people all the time that recognize me because I'm the jester. So because I'm the only one that runs 100-mile races in a costume, I'm very recognizable. Unfortunately, just because of the volume of people I come into, maybe I don't have the best memory techniques, but I don't even remember people, don't remember their faces or their names because I meet so many. But I will run into someone and they will say, I ran this race with you back 4 years ago in Arizona, and I was really, really struggling, and you came by with your cow whistle and your bell, and you just said a couple words like, hey, you're looking good, keep it up, see you at the finish line. And that was just enough to keep me going. And hearing things like that, it just gives me so much fulfillment, and so it gives me enough energy that I can pass on to others. And that's what I feel. It's my job, it's my responsibility now that I've accomplished a lot in the ultra running world. I'm an ambassador, but also I feel I have an obligation to pay that forward, to pay that back to the community.
I love that. And sometimes a mentor or a coach will come in a person you never expected from, right? And sometimes you can help someone that you never expect. That's why I always try to, whoever I meet, I try to meet them with a smile. And if I can do something to make someone else's day a little bit better, it's great, because tomorrow I might meet her. One thing that happened to me, I usually go and buy lunch or coffee at a place in Beverly Hills. And there's almost like once a week or twice a week, I'll meet a lady that stands with a sign and she's hungry. And usually if I have some cash, I will give it to her. But the interesting thing that happened to me that really made me think about my own life was one thing that happened last week. So when I go there, I looked in my pocket and I have $3. So I said, okay, I'll give it to her. And when I came to her, she said, no, 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 not you. You always give me money. And when she said that, I was like, I said, no, of course. But I was like, this person, to be, it takes a lot of guts to be able to stand there, because it means that you're putting yourself on your knees, right? So it's not good for your self-view to do something like that, right? And she wants to survive, of course. I understand that, and that's why I acknowledge that. But when she said that, it was something incredible. And I thought about my own life. Like, why can't I be like that sometimes, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was something that, a real cool lesson.
Well, I truly believe there's the old adage, when the student is ready, the master will appear. And I've seen that as a coach, as a mentor for runners and fellow speakers, that there are times when I've had coaches and mentors myself, and they came into my life at the right time, like my teachers that I told you about, Mrs. Breedlove and Mr. Robinson. And you never know what influence you can have on somebody. And to me, it's amazing that sometimes the simplest act of kindness, a kind word, a smile, one thing that I love doing, and it's kind of selfish, but it's a fun thing to do. I'm on the road a lot because of my work, and so my favorite fast food place is Del Taco. Yeah, yeah, I get, you know, I love the veggie burritos and you know, quick in and out. But the teller at the window, no one ever gives them money. If you go through Starbucks, the baristas, they have that little canister, people put little tips in there. But so giving them a dollar, and because for me, I'm a senior now, I'm 55, so I get the senior discount. So I save a dollar by getting the senior discount, so I just give it back to them. It's amazing how much joy one single dollar will bring them, because they're not. No one does that. No one gives the little drive-through teller, you know, a tip, and little things like that that you can do in your life. And it's the same thing with volunteering. When you volunteer, you get so much more than what you're giving. It's just amazing how that works.
Yeah, I think we have to respect all kind of work. We have to respect. And also, if you're in a job, you have to be proud of it. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not loving that job, at least I'm doing this now, and I'm going to move my life forward.
Sure.
So I just have a couple of more questions to you. One thing that I want to ask you is if you could just say, like, if you can summarize your lessons from all these races and just give it in a couple of sentences to people that don't run or they have something else, what would those lessons be?
It's difficult to summarize it, but I think one, I can kind of encapsulate it in this way. Running a race is kind of metaphorical for life. It's not my goal to convince people to run a marathon. I think everybody should at some time in their life because it's an amazing experience. But statistically, only one in 120 Americans will ever run a marathon. Statistically, only one in 10,000 people will ever run a 100-mile race. So I'm never going to convince the world to run 100-mile races. But the lessons I've learned in a marathon and specifically in 100-mile races is no matter how bad things are, this too shall pass. And if you can just keep putting one foot forward, just one step. When we run 100-mile races, we don't go into it right from the start going, okay, I have 100 miles to go, and then we get through 1 mile. I have 99 miles to go. It's too much. We think, all right, the next aid station is 6 miles down the road. And we go from aid station to aid station. We chunk it or break it into manageable pieces. And then sometimes just going from one aid station to the next is too much. So then it's like, well, just 1 mile. If I can just get through 1 mile. Sometimes the difficulty we're going through at the moment is so hard, physically, mentally, that it's just one step. And so if I get to those points, what I'll usually do is I'll do a countdown from 100 backwards. I'll just start counting my steps. You know, if I can get through 100 steps and focus on that, that puts my mind to focus on my numbers. I'm now counting. I'm not thinking about my adversity. And by the time I get to the one, typically it's like, okay, I'm feeling better now. And if I'm not, I'll start again at 100. But invariably, if you just keep moving forward, it's just relentless forward progress, no matter how slow it is. And this is something I coach to people all the time. It's not your pace, it's your pause or your stop. Stop is what kills you in a race. You can be walking super slow, but you will, as long as you're not missing cutoffs, because all races have cutoff times, but if you're moving, you'll get there. It's the ones who stop, many times, they don't get back up. We have a phrase, we say, beware the chair, because if you come into an aid station, you sit down, sometimes you're not getting back up. It's just too hard. So most of us will come in and you get aid at the aid station. You get food and drink. We'll do it on our feet. And in fact, we'll walk out of the aid station eating and drinking. And then when we're feeling better, start running again. So keep moving. No matter how bad things seem, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And for a person who, in my lifetime, I've had times where I felt suicidal. And I look back on how dark it was and I just can't believe that if I've taken my life, all the things in life I would have missed out on. I have a 7-year-old granddaughter that is just the love of my life. I never would have had that if 9 years ago when I was going through that depression, if I'd have decided, because I had suicide ideations every single day. I would try and figure out how can I kill myself in a way to where my wife is, I had a lot of life insurance, so my wife will get the life insurance. She'll be able to get rid of all this debt and have a good life. And she's a beautiful woman. She'll marry another man and have a good life. How I felt like that's the best thing I could have done for my family, which was totally wrong thinking because my head was in the wrong place. But now I look back on it and it's like, wow, I was so close to throwing in the towel, but for whatever reason, just, you know, kept moving just a little bit forward. And that's 100-mile race, that's life in general, that's everything we deal with.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. And I think we all go through hardship in different layers. And what you're saying, to not give up and to take that, you don't have to have the answer for the rest of your life or even tomorrow. Maybe just take that one next step.
Right.
And don't give up. Like, the people that are watching and listening, don't give up. Like, we don't want you to give up, and you shouldn't want that either, because the sun is going to come out again. Mm-hmm. It always does. And even if you can't see it now, looking back, you can always see it. Look at you now. You have your granddaughter, and you have your kids.
Interesting, so. You would say that sun, because many times we have what's called the witching hours, 100-mile race, and it's from midnight to dusk, and that's one of the toughest times, because you're dealing with your inner demons and whatever you're dealing with out on the course, and it's cold and wet and lonely. But the sun will eventually come out, and when the sun comes out, it's like a whole new day. So a lot of times it's just, we know if we can just get to that first ray of sunlight coming up over the horizon, we know we got it made. Just got to get to the sunlight, just keep moving until the sun comes up.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, Edwin, for coming here today. It means the world for me for you to share your story. I want to thank all of you that have watched this program, for watching this. If you like this, share it with your friends, family. That's how we grow. And we want to help 10 million people in 10 years to achieve their dreams. And I can't do it myself. Ed can't do it himself. But we can do it together as a community. So let's go, guys. Thank you for watching.